From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, to have a special session or not to have a special session? That is the question. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his erudite thoughts on that, and we'll look at the Worldwide Fight for 15 movement on its fourth anniversary. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. In Albany's own version of Groundhog Day, Governor Andrew Cuomo and legislative leaders are still keeping open the possibility of a special session before the year's end that could include legalizing Uber statewide and a pay raise for lawmakers.
Governor Cuomo, during a brief stop in Albany that included presiding over the Electoral College, says he's still trying to work out a deal with the legislature to return before the end of the year to act on a number of issues.
It's up in the air. They could.
One of the potential items would allow ride-sharing services outside of New York City. As first reported by Politico New York, draft legislation is circulating among the governors and legislative councils. It proposes amendments to the state's insurance laws to adequately cover the drivers if there's an accident. Upstaters and Long Islanders would have to pay 50 cents per trip to help fund mass transit in New York City and its suburbs, as well as upstate bus lines. The taxi industry is pushing back, though, saying in a statement that Uber and Lyft drivers on Long Island and upstate should undergo fingerprint background checks, just like regular taxi cab drivers. Uber and Lyft drivers are required to have fingerprint checks in New York City. Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie says he would love to have ride sharing in more places in New York, but he says there are safety concerns that need to be addressed first.
We want to make sure that people are safe, the drivers are safe, potential passengers are safe, and that's some of that is, I think, is getting lost in this debate.
Speaker Hastie says he thinks an agreement can be forged if there's a will.
If people are willing to be flexible and compromise, I think that it can happen. But if people just believe that their position is what it has to be, then I don't know if we get there.
Ethics reform seems to have dropped off the table for now, but the governor is still pushing for changes to the state's hate crimes laws to protect more people after a rise in bias-related incidents after the election of Donald Trump for president. And he'd like to free up more money to help the homeless. Cuomo in recent days has added yet another item to his list, tax breaks.
I would like to see people get more relief on property taxes. Property taxes are crushing the people of this state. It's the number one tax in this state is property tax.
The governor has not provided details. Speaker Hastie also declined to outline the proposal, but says some of his Democratic members have some concerns. All of those measures could wait until the 2017 session, which begins in around 2 weeks. But one item that has to be done by December 31st is a pay raise for lawmakers. Legislators are not allowed to vote on a salary increase for themselves, but they can approve raises for future office holders, and the new term begins on January 4th. But Cuomo says he won't agree to a special session if it's only about a pay raise.
I'm not going to bring them back. And pay millions of dollars to bring them back just so they can vote for a pay raise for themselves. If they want to come back and do the people's business, then we'll have something to talk about.
Lawmakers have not seen a salary increase in almost two decades. Last week, Cuomo and the leader of the Senate, John Flanagan, openly feuded, accusing each other of obstructing negotiations. Senator Flanagan has not commented publicly since then. Speaker Hastie says they were likely just having a bad day. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, this week, a Quinnipiac poll is released that finds that voters across the state approve of Governor Cuomo's handling of his current office by a margin of 49% to 34%, but by a large margin, they don't think he should run for president in 2020. 36% of voters were for the idea, 56% against it.
Well, we do know that Governor Cuomo's popularity is still high in places like New York City and the suburbs. He has the Cuomo name, and it's going to serve him well. However, those numbers are not terribly impressive. I remember his father, and I think he, saying that once you're below 50% in terms of approval rating, you're in trouble. So he would be in political trouble if he had anybody who was going to run against him. But so far, we don't see anybody emerging who really can make a major difference. Now, with that said, I have to say that when Cuomo Papa ran for the fourth time, I used to say all the time, you can't beat somebody with nobody. Well, you did. And George Pataki came along, and it was really more of a, you've been here too long, Mario vote, than it was a pro-Pataki vote, because nobody knew who Pataki was. And he went on to win three terms after he won and beat Cuomo. So anything can happen. Right now, the Republican bench doesn't look too good. Rob Astorino got creamed the last time. There's no great assumption to feel he won't get creamed again this time. But as I say, you never know. And he does seem to be the favored candidate of the Republican establishment.
Meantime, as our Karen DeWitt reports this week, in Albany's own version of Groundhog Day, Governor Cuomo and legislative leaders are still keeping open the possibility of a special session before the year ends that could include legalizing Uber statewide and a pay raise for state lawmakers.
Well, the pay raise is what's really on the table, David, and that's what the legislators want. They don't want to give up what they have to give up, which is a meaningful, not a non-meaningful, as in the past, ethics package. So now we're hearing about, oh boy, well, we'll get Uber upstate. Well, that's good. They should get Uber upstate. If you got Uber downstate, why not upstate? It's ridiculous. Nevertheless, that isn't what you trade a pay raise for. The whole thing that Cuomo has said all along is, hey, we'll give you a pay raise if you agree to meaningful ethics reform, like limiting how much money you can make on the outside, which is at least the major cause of moral corruption in New York State, and we all know it. So this idea of saying the great compromise will be whether you get Uber, that is a laugh.
Despite another win for a Democrat in the state Senate on Long Island this week, Alan, it still looks like the Independent Democratic Conference and the state Senate Republicans will control that chamber.
Well, look, you know, I have nothing good to say about the independent state Democrats who run as Democrats, who say they're for Democratic values, and then who get into bed, and that's figurative, get into bed with the Republican majority and vote for a Republican ticket. Look, what this is all about is that Jeff Klein and his people want more power with the Democrats. The majority of the Democrats won't give it to them. They're angry. They get into bed with the Republicans, they take committee chairmanships, or they get doled out extra favors, and that is why the Republicans remain in power. So New York votes for the Democrats, but it gets the Republicans. Some democracy.
Do you see any compromise being made? Will they get their pay raise? Will the governor's, quote, ethics reforms come to play?
David, I am such a cynic and such a believer in Murphy's Law that if it can go wrong, it will, that I absolutely do believe that it's on the table and it could well happen, and that Cuomo is showing signs of real weakness here and saying, okay, Uber as opposed to ethics reform, which he was for. Look, he came riding in a white horse in the beginning. He said he was going to be for ethics reform. He said he wasn't going to allow them to draw their own districts. They're still drawing their own districts. They're still having stuff on the outside. Some of them are still being hauled off to jail. It is making New York into a laughingstock. And how long before people can say, hey, this just ain't right?
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Congress has approved the Promoting Travel, Commerce, and National Security Act of 2016, sending it to the president's desk. The measure creates a preclearance procedure for Amtrak passengers traveling across the Canadian border and shared clearance functions, especially at small rural crossings. Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley explains.
Generally referred to as the U.S.-Canada Preclearance Bill, the law implements an agreement between the countries crafted in 2015, establishing shared border clearance functions. It also eliminates the need for passenger rail, particularly Amtrak, to stop at the border by establishing preclearance procedures. Plattsburgh North Country Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Gary Douglas says passage of the bill was a top priority this year.
The preclearance agreement arrived at in 2015 is historic in that it created a framework for the U.S. and Canada to do things that are common sense. Now, common sense things may seem like they ought to be easy, but they aren't. When you're talking about two countries' jurisdictions, law enforcement officers operating in another country, what the Act of Congress did was clear away the impediments, resolve the jurisdictional question so that the agreement can actually go into effect.
Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of the 21st District co-introduced the legislation in the House, calling it incredibly important for northern border states.
It will impact tourism and it will also impact commerce in our district. Our economic partnership with Canada is hugely important when it comes to tourism. One of the important provisions in the preclearance legislation deals with Amtrak passengers. So passengers are pre-cleared through the security process so there's not a delay at the border. In addition, it also strengthens our border security. The U.S. and Canada, which have an incredibly strong working relationship, in some of the more rural border crossings, this will allow them to utilize the same facilities, and it's a good steward of taxpayer dollars in that sense. So this is a win-win both for Canada and the U.S.
The U.S. operates pre-clearance facilities at 15 airports in six countries that allow travelers to pass through customs inspections prior to departure. The legislation expands operations to rail between the U.S. and Canada. Passengers on Amtrak's Adirondack Line to and from Montreal are currently stopped at the border, often resulting in delays of more than an hour as Customs and Border Protection clears the entire train. Preclearance is expected to improve tourism and economic opportunities along the entire rail corridor. Amtrak spokesman Craig Schultz expects a number of benefits for their passengers.
One of the things that we'll see, I think, with preclearance is an elimination of any delays to the train that the train may experience at the border should there be a reason for agents to remove somebody from the train for further questioning or for whatever reason. If somebody is detained and unable to enter the country, with preclearance now, that work will be done in the station before the train departs. That alone has a number of benefits to Amtrak as a corporation, as a company. It makes a much more efficient operation for us, and then, of course, for our passengers, it eliminates delays. So there are a number of reasons why this is a good thing.
Vermont Democratic Congressman Peter Welch says he's seen the efficiency of pre-clearance and joint border operations in Europe.
One of the complaints that all of us in the delegation hear about is from our businesses where they have to spend a lot of time and a lot of paperwork trying to get across the border. So anything that can be done to increase the speed of business or increase the speed of tourism is really good. And this pre-clearance is a combination of Canadian and U.S. Commitment to work together to make it easier for business and for tourists.
Parallel legislation must be approved by the Canadian Parliament. Action is expected in Ottawa sometime early in the new year.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
The Fight 415 is a worldwide mobilization for a wage that meets basic needs. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas looks back at the movement, which has just celebrated its four-year anniversary.
Often billed as a fight for fairness, sometimes as a fight for racial justice, Fight for 15 began on November 29, 2012, when more than 100 fast food workers in New York City from eateries like McDonald's, Burger King, KFC, and Pizza Hut walked off their jobs in strike for higher wages, better working conditions, and the right to form a union without retaliation from their managers. It was the largest strike in the history of the fast food industry, and it was a game changer. By May 2014, the movement was a global phenomenon. Fast food workers in 230 cities around the world participated in a one-day strike to protest low wages. One year later, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo called on the state wage board to consider hiking pay for fast food workers. That June, he attended a rally in New York City.
And then you have the minimum wage, which is supposed to be a living wage. When FDR passed the law, that's what he said.
The Cuomo-appointed Fast Food Wage Board in July recommended chain restaurants in New York City with more than 30 locations nationwide up wages to at least $15 an hour by 2018. In September 2015, Vice President Joe Biden visited Manhattan, where he appeared on stage at a labor rally with fellow Democrat Cuomo.
Middle-class wages are still stagnant, and the working poor are living in poverty. That's right. So, Governor, I applaud you for stepping up with a smart, reasonable plan.
A beaming Cuomo walked the crowd through the process that enabled his plans to come to fruition.
So several months ago, we impaneled a wage board to study the minimum wage of fast food workers. And they recommended a wage of $15 an hour. That recommendation went to New York State Commissioner of Labor Mario Mussolino. And I am pleased to announce today that the state of New York's Labor Department has accepted the wage board recommendation in full. And 150,000 fast food workers will see their wages rise to $15 an hour.
The fourth anniversary of the first Fight for 15 was celebrated November 29, 2016. More than 320 cities nationwide participated. A new report from the National Employment Law Project details wage raises that workers have made since the movement began. NELP researcher and policy analyst Yannette Lathrop says the Fight for 15 has brought significant gains to New York.
$15.5 billion to low-wage workers in New York, which is really very welcomed, I'm sure, by low-wage workers since New York, especially New York City and the suburbs around New York City are very expensive places to live in. In other places, in Massachusetts, for example, there is a campaign to raise the minimum wage to 15. There are obviously several places in the Northeast that are also either working or have already increased the minimum wage, including Vermont, Rhode Island, as well in Maine.
Since 2012, at least 20 cities have enacted legislation raising their minimum wages. New York and California have $15 minimum wage laws in place, and voters in four states approved raising their minimum pay in November's election. Lathrop says that, contrary to popular opinion, a lot of small business owners understand that raising their workers' wages is actually good for business in the end.
A survey that was conducted, interestingly enough, by Republican pollster, showing that about 80% of businesses of all sizes are in favor of raising the minimum wage. Small business owners really are more likely than not to also agree that raising the minimum wage is good for them. They may be paying a little bit more to their own workers, so their cost of doing business might go up a little, but they are also going to be, that money is going to be going to workers that are going to be spending it right away at various businesses. So in the end, it actually ends up benefiting them because they will be seeing more, either more customers or more purchases at their own businesses as well.
There's a link to the NELP report at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Support continues to grow for President Obama to award a suffragist with ties to New York's Hudson Valley with a Presidential Citizen's Medal. More than 1,000 groups and individuals have signed the campaign's petition for the New York native and Vassar College graduate to be the recipient. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
Candidates are nominated for the Presidential Citizen's Medal, which recognizes Americans who have performed exemplary deeds of service for their country or their fellow citizens. It is the second highest civilian award in the U.S. The Presidential Medal of Freedom is the first. With 2016 marking the centennial of suffragist Inez Milholland's death, supporters such as Margaret Kern say the timing is right in a women's history story that continues.
It's really another milestone in a very long process. It started in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York, and it's continuing to the present day, and it moves into the future. It's a long-term story.
The petition supporting the nomination of Milholland has been submitted to the White House for consideration. Kern's credits filmmaker Martha Wheelock with helping to circulate Milholland's story. Earlier in 2016, Wheelock produced and distributed Forward Into Light, a documentary about Milholland.
Well, she's one of those unsung heroes that we should know. The most famous suffrage icon you never heard of, I always say. She's best known for the image that she presented in 1913 on a white horse leading the biggest suffrage march in Washington, D.C., where 8,000 women demanded their right to vote.
1913, Washington, D.C., the day before President Woodrow Wilson's inauguration. A massive spectacle of 8,000 women displaying their demand for the right to vote. The peaceful, dignified, colorful march is suddenly interrupted.
Men spat upon the women, slapped them in the face, tripped them, pelted them with cigar stubs, pulled them off floats, tore off their skirts, and cursed them. New York Times.
Now there appears a gallant figure out of the pressing throngs, a girl in white upon a white horse, dressed in flowing crusader's cloak, Inez Milholland. She courageously parts the way through the hordes of men and drives an opening for the marchers to continue. Hazel McKay.
2017 denotes the centennial of women securing the right to vote in New York, and 2020 the centennial of the passage of the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote. Kearns is co-chair of the nonprofit National Women's History Project Inez Milholland Centennial Campaign. She says Milholland, who was born in Brooklyn in 1886, was a Vassar College graduate some 60 years before the Poughkeepsie-based college became co-ed.
The first rumblings for Inez Milholland happened when she was a student in the Hudson Valley shortly before her graduation from Vassar in 1909. And she was popular, she was an athlete, she was opinionated, and she got into trouble because the president of Vassar didn't want women talking about voting rights on campus. And so that was her first launching into the public arena.
Milholland went to New York University School of Law and practiced law in the city while advocating for women's voting rights. Kern's grandmother knew Milholland.
My grandmother, Edna Kearns, knew Inez Milholland, and she knew, of course, a lot of different individual activists in New York State. And New York is the cradle of the women's rights movement in the United States. It wasn't a large group of people, but they worked hard. My grandmother worked from, I'd say, 1910 to 1920, and she was associated with all the different state and regional and national organizations. At the very end, she picketed the White House with Alice Paul and the National Women's Party. And the Sewell Belmont House, which is now renamed the Belmont Paul National Monument in Washington, D.C., was the headquarters. And so in 2017, in January, the picketing of the White House started 100 years ago. So it's really a very rich legacy that we have, and Inez Milholland is an important part of it.
And Kearns points out there is a Christmas Day legacy here. On Christmas in 1916, more than 1,000 women and men gathered in Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol for a memorial service for Milholland. It was the first time a woman was honored there. After refusing to cancel a speaking tour for the 19th Amendment in 1916, Milholland collapsed and died 3 weeks later.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1652. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.